Hey, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to the School Sucks podcast. Today is June 18th, and just a quick update on the series that I began in the last podcast, How the Truth Became Illegal. Part two is going to take a little more time. There's certainly a lot of information there, and I just want to spend a few more days figuring out the best way to organize and present it to you, so it will either appear right before I leave for Porkfest or shortly after I return. However, while I was recording that show, this question kept coming up that didn't get worked into the first or the second part. And it is about the, apparently, at least from my observations anyway, the two highest values in adult society today, at least in a political context. And those two highest values are safety and fairness. And the question I had is, how did this happen? You know, because we're talking about the adult world. Folks, those were the two highest values, safety and fairness, at my elementary school. So this childification of the American culture anyway, which supposedly has built into it all of this individualism and autonomy and freedom, you know, at least in its relationship to government, is something that we've explored numerous times on the show in the past. But it also connects to this kind of vague ideal that is also often discussed of a mass awakening. And this is something like even 4 or 5 years ago, when Obama was elected, I was very naive about this possibility, naive in the short term anyway. Right, where, oh, once this, you know, great new progressive figure representative of change takes power, and, you know, nothing that people were complaining about from the previous 8 years or whatever is going to be dramatically different, people will see. Well, people will not see. And at least in the short term, I think the idea of some kind of mass awakening to the realities of government is near impossible. It doesn't mean that it is never possible, you know, as generations go on. But I think it's an ideal, a vague ideal, because what does that really even mean that we should probably let go of? But I am optimistic in that it seems that something that has always existed, which is a small but vocal minority that speaks out in opposition to either, you know, secretive central plans or widely publicized new government programs and agendas, seems to have today, or certainly has today, it's not a seems, certainly has today better tools at their disposal. I don't think I need to go into detail about what those tools are. And a small but vocal minority can make a very, very significant difference in, at the very least, retarding the so-called progress of those in power. This is a live show that was recorded on June 6th, and we start out the show. I really just kind of intended this article as a warm-up. It actually wound up tying together nicely through the theme of central planning with the main topic we had for the show. The article that we start with is a piece from the Huffington Post called People Getting Dumber, and it discusses the alleged decline in IQ over the course of the last century, which is, of course, contrary to some studies on the subject. It led us into maybe not a terribly in-depth, but certainly interesting discussion on the topic of eugenics. Many people are unfamiliar with this topic. We have not spent a lot of time discussing it on the show, but eugenics is a product of the somewhat scientific and somewhat, in some cases, pseudoscientific revolution that occurred in the latter half of the 19th century. A lot of crossover between eugenics and phrenology, a science, air quotes, where the phrenologists can come to understand the personality of a subject better through the bumps on their head. So eugenics was serious business, though. And if you only know of the idea of eugenics through the practice of the Nazis in the 30s and the 40s, that's not the complete story. Now, obviously, we can't give you the complete story here. Our friends at Tragedy and Hope have done some great work on this subject. I know it sounds very conspiratorial, doesn't it? But it's a very real thing. Like I said already, it extends far further into the future than many might think, beyond the Nazis. So I just wanted to lay some groundwork and establish some historical context with a very brief lecture. And by brief, I mean about 6 minutes long, given by Mary Shalee, who is the curator of the ULC Petrie Museum on Galton. And that is Francis Galton, the father of eugenics. After this, we will get right into this show. I hope you enjoy this. Thank you for listening and take care.
Francis Galton was connected to University College London because he left his collection here. He left his archive of letters, of everything you could think of to do with Francis Galton, to this college. This is partly because towards the end of his life, he established something known as an anthropometric lab, which is essentially a lab for measuring people and detailing people's heredity. And it's this legacy that we're investigating in two exhibitions at the library and in the Petrie Museum, and a public programme which I've been working on. And Francis Galton is probably one of these massive polymath Victorian scientists, but today he's probably best known for his work on the area of eugenics, a word and term which he in fact coined from two Greek words, one for well, you, and one for blood or stock, sheen, or gen, or where we get our word genetics from, or gene. He put these two words together to describe a movement that would encourage there to be better human stock, as he saw it, by the breeding of eugenically better or perfect people together. And therefore you would eradicate things like even alcoholism, TB, you would establish a kind of better health of certain people, you would establish a better intellectual level, those kind of ideas. But by the end of his life, by 1911, and certainly as a sort of build-up in the 1900s of interest and acceptance of eugenic ideas, there's a eugenics education society established, which are kind of a lobbying group. Most people of kind of upper middle class, upper class backgrounds accept to some extent sort of social and cultural eugenics, more positive eugenics, which is encouraging the breeding of, you know, eugenically perfect people rather than negative, which is kind of discouraging or even stopping enforcing sort of people who are not deemed to be fit to have children. And it's in Britain, it's very much a sort of social and political movement rather than an area that actually made laws and stopped people doing things or encouraged people to do things. But of course, eugenics had an international impact even in Canada, America, South Africa, across the empire as it was in the British Empire then. But also in Europe, in Scandinavian countries, in mainland Europe, in Germany, for example. And it's this international legacy that obviously has come back to haunt eugenics, really since the Second World War, because of Nazism and because of the horrendous atrocities practiced by the Nazis through their eugenic programme against people with disabilities, against Jews, against people who were just considered feeble-minded or unfit to breed for whatever reason they determined. And also then, of course, massive sterilisation programmes in some areas of the United States and elsewhere. It's this kind of negative eugenics that's really haunted eugenics. And I think that's been a real problem, which is an understatement, but it's been a real problem in terms of analysing the impact of eugenics in Britain and the legacy of it today, because we tend to establish ourselves as the good guys against the bad Nazi guys or against the bad racists in America who sterilised lots of black men. That, you know, in Britain we didn't really do very much around eugenics. We just had a kind of social movement, but it wasn't that wide-ranging. And in some ways that's kind of true, but in other ways it's meant that we've not really interrogated some of our social assumptions about some of the areas the Eugenics Society campaigned on. And just to pick out a few examples, areas such as who should have children, about how we screen people for having children, how our assumptions about parenting, for example, or watching things like the royal wedding and recently in the marriage of Kate Middleton, a so-called commoner to a member of the royal family, the next king after the next in line, if you like. And it was interesting hearing the commentary when she was marrying William about how she was bringing good different stock and how her breeding was different to William's, and these were the kind of words that commentators were using. And in the newspapers there was sort of Kate's family tree and investigation into her heredity, in a way that's actually far more about class than anything to do with birth, and far more about sort of eugenic ideas about what constitutes breeding. And I was quite shocked by the use of some of these words like stock and breeding to sort of bring new blood into the royal family. And I think that shows that these ideas, these assumptions haven't gone away. And really what we should be doing, and what we should be doing, I think, in this centenary year of Francis Galton, is on the one hand celebrating all his great work, on the other hand commemorating the legacy for the people that his work also affected, but also interrogating ourselves on our history and also our own assumptions as academics and what that presents to non-academics in wider society about whether those, how many of that, those assumptions are still with us today, and how much we should be thinking about things differently around medicine, around representation, and around class.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the School Sucks Live show for Thursday, June 6th, 2013.
Oh, yeah. Is that the date already?
It is. 6613. I'm Brett.
I feel like there's something important that was happening.
You might remember me from the first 222 episodes of School Sucks Podcast.
Refresh my memory.
In the studio with me tonight, Corey and... A new voice and an old friend, Joe.
Joe.
Hello, everyone.
So you said that there were some interesting things. We do like a little warm-up show prior to the regular show, and you said, Corey, there were some interesting things that were happening in the chat.
Well, regarding the stated topic about how people are getting dumber, do we mean in the USA or in the world? Because the stats are probably different. Apparently, the average global IQ is going up every year.
Right.
That's an interesting statistic. I mean, does that mean just as stupid people are dying, or people are actually getting smarter?
From what I remember from reading the article earlier today, it is probably focused in the United States.
Yeah, probably.
Anything else?
It's a HuffPost article. Perceived intelligence is also an in-group, out-group feature. People in your group are smarter than people outside of your group.
Can we elaborate on that a little bit? Or do you know? Yeah.
People who are similar to you, you perceive them as being more intelligent than people who are different from you.
I really just wanted to use this article to warm up tonight because there are people hard at work at making folks dumber out there. I think that this article attributes it to something completely different. What do we got, Corey?
Okay. So the Huffington Post wonders aloud, people getting dumber? Human intelligence has declined since Victorian era. Research suggests. Now,
arbitrary era set by people, right?
Yeah, based on an arbitrary test. Our technology may be getting smarter, but a provocative new study suggests human intelligence is on the decline. In fact, it indicates that Westerners have lost 14 IQ points on average since the Victorian era. What exactly explains this decline? Study co-author, this is why you wanted me to read this article, isn't it, Brett?
Why?
So I would have to say this person's name.
I'll try to say it.
Dr. Jan Nijenhuis.
Let's stop for a minute and I'll just try to pronounce it. And then when I edit this for the podcast, I'll take the best one.
I'm going to type it into chat so that everybody else can play along at home and try to pronounce it at home.
I would say it Nijenwies.
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 All right, back on track. Study co-author Dr. Jan de Unpronounceable, professor of work and organizational psychology at the University of Amsterdam. It's Dutch. Clue number one. Points to the fact that women of high intelligence tend to have fewer children than do women of lower intelligence. This negative association between IQ and fertility has been demonstrated time and again in research over the last century. But this isn't the first evidence of a possible decline in human intelligence. The reduction in human intelligence, if there is any reduction, would have begun at the time that genetic selection became more relaxed, Dr. Gerald Crabtree, professor of pathology and developmental biology at Stanford University, told the Huffington Post in an email. I projected this occurred as our ancestors began to live in more supportive, high-density societies, cities, and had access to steady supply of food. Both of these might have resulted from the invention of agriculture, which occurred about 5,000 to 12,000 years ago. As for Dr. Unpronounceable and colleagues, they analyzed the results of 14 intelligence studies conducted between 1884 to 2004, including one by Sir Francis Galton, an English anthropologist and a cousin of Charles Darwin. Each study gauged participants' so-called visual reaction times, how long it took them to press a button in response to seeing a stimulus. Reaction time reflects a person's mental processing speed and so is considered an indication of general intelligence.
And,
really?
I kind of want to stop there and like, talk about this.
Yeah, there was a lot in there.
Why do they mention that this guy is a cousin of Charles Darwin? What does that have
to do
with
that
anything?
That's
like a name drop.
Yeah. It's, well...
Well, a little bit more than that, but essentially...
There is, I mean, the history of Darwin's family is interesting, and Joe actually mentioned something to me when I sent him the article.
I guess in the second paragraph, they say something about the breeding stock or people getting lax with their breeding, and it's almost like they're saying that a eugenics-type program would almost be preferable, like people are breeding with more stupid people or stupid people are outbreeding smart people, and therefore society is generally on a decline. And that just seems terribly like elitist and evil, right? Like people aren't marrying and breeding the right types of people, and so now humanity is suffering because of that.
Yeah.
This article is reminding me of the first 10 minutes of Idiocracy.
Absolutely.
This is exactly what they're describing, you know, where natural selection stops favoring, you know, positive traits and just starts favoring people who f*** the most.
I agree. We might have to wait until we take a break, but I want to look up this cousin of Darwin, and I want to see what other connections he has, because, I mean, eugenics is a real thing. And, I mean, how successful has the implementation been anywhere outside of Nazi Germany? Hitler, people think that he's treated like this, you know, evil historical mastermind.
Right.
But he was just a madman, basically. And I think that's not a controversial thing for me to say, but...
We're going to get letters.
Even though he did lay out a bit of a plan for what he wanted to do in Mein Kampf, like 20 years prior, he was really just impressed by people who would bring to him the most bold and ostentatious ideas. And people would write him letters like Santa Claus, basically. Like, can we name something after you? Would you come here and would you bless this? What do you think I should...
Can I have a pony?
Yeah, so people wanted to actually, in Nazi Germany, they wanted to control, in the Reich, they wanted to be the one who controlled the mail to Hitler, because people would say, you should do this. And if it was crazy enough, Hitler, I guess, would say, yeah, we should do that.
Yeah.
So some guy wrote a letter and said, I have a child who's a terrible burden. He's mentally retarded. Why can't I kill him? And Hitler said,
why not indeed?
Why can't you kill him? And that was actually...
I never thought about that.
They say that that was actual... Now, obviously, the roots of Nazism go much deeper back, I think, into like Fabian socialism, where this favored racist thing. And it really connected to Darwin, too. And I can flesh that out a little bit better maybe in the next segment, because I want to look a couple of things up.
Okay.
But I'm interested in who this Galton is. And
James says it's a name drop for their self-described rational audience. They'll immediately consider it credible.
Very.
Like it's an appeal to authority, kind of.
Yes.
That's what the chat
this
is
This guy
for.
Must know
Thanks,
what he's
James.
Right? This guy must know what he's talking about because he's Charles Darwin's cousin.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, how many crazy cousins do you have, right?
Yeah.
Darwin did some very interesting and obviously very important work, but how into these ideas was he? So that's something that I do want to get a little bit more into. But yeah, we can keep going with this if there's no other thoughts that should be dealt with now.
In the late 19th century, visual reaction times averaged about 194 milliseconds, the analysis showed. In 2004, that time had grown to 275 milliseconds. Even though the machine gauging reaction time in the late 19th century was less sophisticated than that used in recent years, Dr. told the Huffington Post that the old data is directly comparable to modern data. Okay, if he says so. Other research has suggested an apparent rise in IQ scores since the 1940s, a phenomenon known as the Flynn effect.
The Flynn effect, this is a definition right here, the rise in each successive generation's IQ test scores named for the intelligence researcher James Flynn.
Doctors suggested the Flynn effect reflects the influence of environmental factors such as better education, hygiene, and nutrition, and may mask the true decline in genetically inherited intelligence in the Western world. This new research was published in the April 13th issue of Intelligence.
Now, I'm guessing that inbreeding is also way down.
Yeah, I'm going to assume so.
Worldwide.
One would think, yes.
In the last, let's say, three centuries. Really just probably the British royal family doing it today.
Other royal families.
And people in Fremont, New Hampshire, from what I've seen. The back of their heads are very flat. That's usually a sign. You know, a really flat back of the head. Like really? The neck just goes straight up.
To be fair, it's not just the British monarchy. It's other European monarchies as well.
Well, they were all related.
Yeah, it's true. Like, you know, Queen Elizabeth is married to her first cousin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Who was German.
Not just the British, but a lot of the royal families in Europe are actually all kind of mixed together in strange ways as well.
So none of us are that distantly related to pretty much anyone else on the planet is the weird thing when you think genetics is just weird.
Yeah, yeah.
You could pick any random person on the planet and trace both your lineages back, and you would never have to go back more than 40 generations to find a common ancestor. And that doesn't sound like a big enough number.
So the more, like, important people are, as you, you know, kind of go...
The smaller that number is.
Elite, yeah, you'd have to go back, because there was all this, like, oh, well, these guys are fourth cousins, you know, and they're running for president against each other. Yeah, so that makes sense, yeah, that there would be certain favored families as well. Was that the end of the article?
That was. I'm kind of curious about this test, this reaction time test. It sounds skeptical.
Well, there's a picture of the machine, right?
I see
there.
That. I work with technology on a regular basis. Like, I'm an engineer, and I know when you switch from one piece of equipment to another, there usually is like a considerable just like offset in like the previous data set from the one from the next, just because your instrumentation is different. And I can't imagine that. Over 150 years, however long they've been running this test, that they're accurately nailing something down to, I don't know, milliseconds? They're saying single milliseconds?
They're saying 1/1000th of a second. It's called the hip chronoscope scope, if anybody wants to do any research who's watching in the chat. Anything else that anyone has added? He is the father of eugenics as well. Coined the term eugenics, one person says. Galton.
Yeah, Sir Francis Galton.
Father of eugenics.
Oh, what a claim to fame, huh?
Very insightful on your part, Joe, to pick up the kind of code language of that when they're citing the work of... How is he actually cited again? It says...
It's always they analyzed the results of 14 intelligence studies conducted between 1884 to 2004, including one out of 14 studies by Sir Francis Galton, an English anthropologist and a cousin of Charles Darwin.
And data from that, I mean... Scientists have bias, and especially older studies obviously have bias. What segment of the population are they studying? I mean, there's lots of questions to ask about these older studies. I mean, you should be asking these questions with new studies. How are you supposed to find the answer to studies that happened 100 years ago?
Yeah.
With all the prejudices, too, that would have been totally acceptable in 1884.
Who were the subjects of these tests, anyway? I mean, it was in 1884, do I believe that they were testing anybody but white males?
He said to his research assistants, he said, go out there on the streets and find me the 100 flattest heads you can and bring them in. So I actually want to grab a book. This is, for those of you who are unfamiliar, a book that I've probably used at least a handful of times on the show in the past, if not more. It's written by John Taylor Gatto. It's called The Underground History of American Education. And that sounds like it only covers a finite set of subjects, but it is very, very broad. And he basically traces the history of every group that has come in to influence modern public schooling in America, from the Prussians to the behaviorists to, like I mentioned earlier in this show, the Fabian socialists. Chapter 11 is called The Crunch, and the way the book is divided up is into like these short passages that usually a little less than a page. They're all numbered. So I wanted to read 134 and 135. 134 is called The Struggle for Homogeneity. In 1882, an Atlantic Monthly writer predicted a coming struggle for preservation of the American social order. European immigrants were polarizing the country, upsetting the homogeneity on which free government must rest. That was a quote. The idea of a necessary homogeneity made it certain that all lanes out of the 1880s led to orthodoxy on a national scale. There was to be an official American highway, its roadbed built from police manuals and school teacher training texts. Citizens would now be graded against the official standard up to the highest mark, 100% American. In the 30 years between 1890 and 1920, the original idea of America as a cosmopolitan association of peoples, each with its own integrity, gave way to urgent calls for national unity. Even before World War I added its own shrill hysterics to the national project of regimentation, new social agencies were in full cry on every front, aggressively taking the battle of Americanization to millions of bewildered immigrants and their children. I know this is going to get us way off topic here, but why do you think that is? What do you think it is about the last decades of the 1800s, not just in the United States, but around the world, that is pushing people more towards this homogeneity and regimentation, this national identity that, as Gatto claims here anyway, did not exist before? And think about what's going on in Europe at this time, leading up to the wars. All these countries are becoming hyper-nationalistic.
All the colonization and the fighting for resources overseas, and just empire. Well, in general, empire is growing, especially in Europe in this period of time.
Right.
I mean, it was a relatively peaceful time before this, but now all the military machines are just starting to gear up at the turn of the century.
And they,
I mean, the world is getting smaller.
And they're motivating their people, obviously, to fight for these very specific projects that have very specific benefits to a very specific few.
Mm.
But they can't say to their populations, like, what? We want their shit for us.
Right.
You know, and you'll get it. You know, we'll give you a uniform. You go get it.
Because if we don't do it, they're going to do it to us.
And a more cynical person like myself would even say that this was the motivation behind the American Revolution, that you could animate people with this collective sense of, you know, not just a sense of belonging, but also a sense of duty to something that actually is of great value, you know, human liberty, independence, autonomy. And you can motivate people to fight for a cause that actually has really underneath it a very, very different agenda. So as the quest for empire heats up with the old players like the British and the French, but also new players as the 20th century comes, the United States, the Germans, and even the Japanese, there's all of this hyper-nationalism. And Corbett was saying to me when he was on the show that you would not even believe, even an American might be surprised by how collectivistic the culture is in Japan still. But that's something that when you have in your management circles an imperial kind of agenda, you really have to push patriotism, nationalism, collectivism. So all of that makes perfect sense, that at this time that we're talking about in the late 1800s, there is this push for Americanization, as they call it. There's also a huge wave of immigrants coming into the United States, mostly from... Where are they coming? Well, there was black people coming north from the south.
The south, that's
technically not immigrants. Ireland was a huge one.
Northern Europe.
Yeah.
Europeans.
So that was the first wave of immigrants, like in the latter
Polish
half of the 1800s.
Coming over at
Time Polish, also. That was a big one.
A lot of Italians getting sent back.
The elite managed birth control movement, which culminated 100 years later in the legalization of abortion, became visible and active during this period, annually distributing millions of pieces of literature aimed at controlling lower-class breeding instincts, an urgent priority on the national elitist agenda. Malthus, Darwin, Galton, and Pearson became secular saints at the Lawrence and Sheffield Scientific Schools at Harvard and Yale. Judge Ben Lindsay of the Denver Children's Court, flogging easy access to pornography as an indirect form of sterilization for underclass men, was a different tile in the same mosaic, as was institutional adoption. In those crucial years, a sudden host of licensing acts closed down employment in a wide range of lucrative work, rationing the right to practice trades as much as kings and queens of England had done. Work was distributed to favored groups and individuals who were willing to satisfy screening commissions that they met the qualifications often unrelated to the actual work. Well, that's still true. Licensing suddenly became an important factor in economic life, just as it had been in Royal England. This professionalization movement endowed favored colleagues in institutes, text publishers, testing agencies, clothing manufacturers, and other allies with virtual sinecures. Professional schools, even for bus drivers and detectives, imposed the chastening discipline of elaborate formal procedures, expensive and time-consuming training on what had once been areas of relatively free-form career design. And medicine, law, architecture, engineering, pharmacology, the blue ribbon work licenses, were suddenly rigorously monitored, rationed by political fortune. Immigrants were often excluded from meeting these qualification demands and were plunged into destitution, their families disintegrating under the artificial stresses. Others, like my own family, scrambled to abandon their home culture as far as possible in a go-along-with-the-crowd response to danger. One of the hardest things for any present-day reader to grasp about this era was the brazenness of the regimentation. Scientific management was in its most enthusiastic public phase then, monumentally zealous, maddeningly smug. The state lay under effective control of a relatively small number of powerful families freed by the Darwinian religion from ethical obligation to a democratic national agenda, or even to its familiar Republican-libertarian antithesis. Yet those antagonists comprise the bedrock antinomies of our once revolutionary public order. And without the eternal argument they provoked, there was no recognizable America. Any problems or questions with anything I just read? Anyone in the chat getting?
No, the chat's been mostly quiet. Ustreamer 260345 has some good recommendations. This one was from a while back. War Against the Weak by Edwin Black speaks extensively about Galton and eugenics as a whole. And he also recommended looking into Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood.
Yes. I read that one. I know that was a little bit lengthy, but I wanted to just lay the context for this next one, section 135, which is a little bit shorter. It's called Eugenics Arrives. Between 1890 and 1920, the percentage of our population adjudged feeble-minded and condemned to institutional confinement more than doubled in that 30-year period where these guys were very active. The long-contemplated hygienic form of social control formulated by 18th-century German social thinker Johann Frank, complete medical policing, was launched with a vengeance. Few intimidations are more effective than the threat of a stay in an insane asylum. Did the population of crazies really double in those three decades? The answer given by one contemporary was elliptically Darwinian. Quote, marriage of these inferiors is a veritable manufactory of degenerates. Unquote. It could no longer go unchecked. The American Birth Control League left no doubt about its plans. Its position, as expressed by Yale psychologist Arnold Gazelle, was that, quote, society need not wait for perfection of the infant science of eugenics before proceeding upon a course which will prevent renewal of defective protoplasm contaminating the stream of life, unquote. Good grief. Gazelle's The Family and the Nation, written in 1909, a thorough product of the new zeitgeist, advocated, quote, eugenic violence in dealing with inferiors. According to Gazelle, quote, we must do as with the feeble-minded, organize the extinction of the tribe. Here was a far different promise of American life, a Connecticut Valley Yale-style pledge. Yet governors of the Birth Control League were acclaimed heroes in every progressive assembly. With this thrust, old-line Calvinism converted its theological elements into scientific truth, supported mathematically by the new Galtonian discipline of statistics. Yale was the most important command center for the reemergence of the old-time Puritan religion, now thoroughly disguised behind the language of research methodology. The eugenics movement began by Galton in England was energetically spread to the United States by his followers. Besides destroying the lesser breeds, as they are now routinely called, by abortion, sterilization, adoption, celibacy, two-job family separation, low wage rates to dull the zest for life, and above all, schooling to dull the mind and debase the character, other methods were clinically discussed in journals, including a childlessness which could be induced through easy access to pornography. I don't get that.
Yeah, I don't.
I mean, I'm not saying that. I don't think that Gatto is bringing that up.
No.
I think he's saying that they were talking about it.
Because instead of making babies, you are practicing onanism, to use a tasteful technical term, and spilling your seed on the ground, so to speak, instead of impregnating your women. I think it's very interesting that he makes the analogy to Calvinism. Because Calvinism, as the religious doctrine, is the belief that certain people are predestined to go to heaven or hell. And no matter what you do, no matter how horrible you are, you'll go to heaven. And no matter how good you are, you'll go to hell, if that's how your destiny has been predecided by God.
Well, remember, too, that a lot of these people, you always hear these conspiracy theories about, oh, they pray to an owl, or they do, you know, they sacrifice kids. Well, a lot of the people who wind up in these little cliques or these little groups that are very real, and whether they do that stuff or not, they often tell themselves and maybe others a story about their megalomania by attaching it to something supernatural, right? Like, oh, this is our destiny. It's just our destiny. Hitler did that, right? Like, oh, it's, you know, I mean, yeah, it looks bad, but it's our destiny. You know, got to do what you got to do to get to destiny.
Right.
So Gatto talks a lot about Calvinism because that provides a real foundation to a lot of this kind of, well, some people are just better than others.
Right.
You know, and then trying to attach the, I mean, once you couldn't use God anymore.
Right.
You had to come up with some sort of pseudoscience to wrap it around, or something that people would actually believe in.
And exactly. it's still a kind of an emotionally detached, it's a way of providing a value judgment on someone in a sort of a detached way. It's like some people are just feeble-minded and some people aren't. You know, it's not nothing against them. It's just how it is.
It's like a nice zero tolerance type of thing. Very black and white. You don't really need to even think about it. It's like, oh, well, that's just who that is. And I don't really even have to worry about it because God already has a plan for him if we're talking about Calvinism. Yeah. So
it also removes accountability very nicely.
Yep.
Just like zero tolerance.
Yep.
We didn't make the rules.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's just how the universe is. We're just living here.
At the same time, those deemed inferior would be turned into eunuchs. Galtonians advocated the notion of breeding a super race. Humanist Scott Nearing wrote his masterpiece, The Super Race, An American Problem, in 1912, just as the drive to destroy an academic curriculum in public schools was reaching its first crescendo. By problem, Nearing wasn't referring to a moral dilemma. Rather, he was simply arguing that only America had the resources to meet the engineering challenge posed in creating supermen out of genetic raw stock.
What I think is kind of interesting is just how parallel all these ideas are running throughout all of the academics and elite in this time in history. Like, it's not just in America. I mean, it's in Britain and in Germany. All these ideas are just being spread around and being slowly implemented. Just happened to crop up the most violently in, you know, one section. It's not to say it wouldn't have cropped up elsewhere, you know, had things gone differently in the United States or in, you know, England or something. Because all the people ruling like those ideas, you know, were
were. It's real easy to like those ideas when you're at the top.
Yeah, exactly.
When you get to decide who's feeble-minded and who's not.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get you.
I think there's also a phrase I used recently on another show, actually, about the modern pharmacological problem of, you know, diagnosing all these kids as defective with ADHD or whatever and putting them on drugs. It's also kind of an accidental conspiracy of obedience, right? People's trust and obedience to authority, where it takes very, very few people to perpetrate a mass excitement for eugenics. Like, Darwin said it's good. Galton said it's good. And then a lot of people probably just follow trends, especially in academia, where so much of the momentum of what's done is driven by, like, sycophantic students of these professors, right, go ahead.
Well, I just think, going back to the article, they name-dropped this guy who is the father of eugenics in this article like it was a good thing, right? Like, they're pandering to the people who think eugenic or who don't know that this guy, like, made his career on saying that we should sterilize people who aren't good enough. Oh, we'll just name-drop this dude and, you know, that'll be great. That's just even worse, right?
And because we know nobody knows who he is, we'll mention that he's Darwin's cousin.
Yeah.
Who wrote this?
Yeah, seriously.
But as someone in the chat has just pointed out, it's all just central planning. Now you're centrally planning the genetics of the American race.
I mean, if you're dropping this guy's name, you would have to think that he would know a little bit about it, right? I mean, you're not just going to, you know.
I don't know.
Maybe. I don't.
You don't.
I don't write for the Huffington Post, so I don't know what type of scrutiny they put their writers through.
I don't see anything else. Like, it's not like she's got like a hardline progressive eugenics kind of agenda here. I mean, moths drive car.
You know, the thing is,
model behavior for robots.
I bet Francis Galton's name came up when she was doing research for the article, and the fact that he was an anthropologist and Charles Darwin's cousin was as much research as she did.
It's possible. And it might not be like if you put his name into Wikipedia, there might not be a lot of like really damning stuff that comes up about him in the first paragraph, you know? So
maybe
he's not even in the first five Sir Francis's that come up on you.
No, it does say a polymath, anthropologist, eugenicist, tropical explorer. Well, he's very well rounded. Geographer, inventor, meteorologist, proto-geneticist.
Psychometrician.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Eugenics, I think, is only mentioned that once, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a pioneer in eugenics, coining the term itself in the phrase nature versus nurture.
That makes eugenics sound really, really harmless.
Yeah.
In his book, The Hereditary Genius, written in 1869, that was the first social scientific attempt to study genius and greatness. As an investigator of the human mind, he founded psychometrics, the science of measuring mental faculties, and differential psychology and the lexical hypothesis of personality. He devised a method for classifying fingerprints that proved useful in forensic science. He also conducted research on the power of prayer.
Oh, boy.
Concluding that it had none by its null effects on the longevity of those prayed for. So it doesn't make him sound like the devil. And you also have to know what eugenics is, right? Because if you don't have the grammar, what is eugenics, when you read that paragraph.
It just sounds like any of his other professions or degrees or, you know, that they have listed off, ones that don't even exist anymore. So,
yeah. So, yeah, I mean, if you don't know what eugenics is, there's nothing about that that's particularly damning. He looks like a serious man. He looks like somebody who will be taken seriously.
If you just click on the little blue where it says eugenics in blue text, you could find out everything you need to know about eugenics. But that is a dangerous game.
On Wikipedia?
Yeah.
We can tie this to our other story about Common Core. I mean, they're definitely related, right? Like, it's all, we're talking about central planning. You know, and the other story that we are going to cover tonight is not a new thing. I was watching some clips of Glenn Beck before the show, and he was interviewing some guy about this Common Core educational standards thing that Obama wanted to do, as if it was some new evil plan. I've known about this very same thing. It's existed just with different names at least since the, I think, the 80s. It's not very different than No Child Left Behind. And do you remember the show we did about behaviorism in disguise, where we watched the clips of that woman, Peg Luxick, in that talk she gave on YouTube called Who Controls Our Children?
Right.
She was talking about the same thing. That looked like it was from the early 90s, where she said they're trying to set up all of these methods of tracking your children.
Right.
And, you know, they have these rubrics that they use to force these behavioral outcomes that they want. So it's not even really about content mastery. I mean, that's one argument you could make for school being good, is kids go there and they master a lot of content, right? Which is supposed to be what the purpose of it is. But what she was saying is, as they were looking at the state standards that were coming down from the Federal Department of Education, and she was saying, I mean, there are people, another video that we tied into that, it might have been that show or it might have been the one right after it, was this guy from some conservative institution giving a talk. And he was saying, this all goes to the UN. You know, this is all this sustainable living stuff is all part of UNESCO. And then we interviewed Neil, one of the hosts of Flaming Freedom at Liberty Forum, and he said he went to a UNESCO high school.
Wow.
Yeah, like a UN-sponsored program in a high school. So that, I mean, as long as you have, simply put, a coercive system, right, where attendance is compulsory and funding is compulsory, all of the worst people, frankly, are going to try to grab its reins and use it to, you know, forward their agenda. I saw this. People wanted me to talk a while back about this Ron Paul homeschool curriculum. And I said, well, I'm not really interested, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Ron Paul is a nice guy, but I'm not interested in his homeschool curriculum. But I think it grew out of his opposition to what we're talking about, Common Core. So I want to pull that up. I wanted to read, this is a very, very short piece, and it deals with our previous topic of people being dumb. Common Core nationalizes and dumbs down public school curriculum. In addition to shredding civil liberties, launching a utopian global war for democracy, and going on a spending spree that would make LBJ blush, the so-called conservative Bush administration dramatically increased federal control over education via the No Child Left Behind Act. During my time in Congress, I heard nothing but complaints about this law from teachers, administrators, and most importantly, students and parents. Most of the complaints concerned No Child Left Behind's testing requirements, which encouraged educators to teach to the test. Sadly, but not surprisingly, instead of improving education by repealing No Child Left Behind's testing and other mandates, the Obama administration is increasing national control over schools via the Common Core initiative. Common Core is a new curriculum developed by a panel of so-called educational experts. The administration is trying to turn Common Core into a national curriculum by offering states increased federal education funding if they impose Common Core's curriculum on their public schools.
Isn't this already in effect? Don't they have a, or maybe I'm wrong, there's no federal curriculum that gets passed down, or is it just, is it something that they're, not bribed, but are they, do they have standards that they're supposed to meet currently? Is that
how
it's set?
There's federal tests, right? That they have to make sure the kids pass or else they don't get funding.
Is it tests, or is it just like a federal standard that the test has to, like, adapt to?
That's a good question.
What this woman, Peg Luxick, said in this talk, Who Controls Our Children, which is her having the exact same complaints and concerns that Ron Paul is having in this article that I think was written in the last couple weeks. Yeah.
May 27th.
Is that there is a de facto national curriculum already. And that you don't say the national curriculum because that makes it sound like North Korea or Nazi Germany, but it's real, and it's been real for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
And the way that is accomplished is through the strings attached to funding, which have a tendency to become chains, right? So,
well, that's how they're doing everything these days.
And that is that it basically has how every federal department disseminates an agenda down to state levels is they dangle funding. A lot of the police action that we're seeing, you know, even right down to local departments, is like, I was talking to some cop maybe a couple of years ago, and they were talking about all these DWI arrests that they were getting.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, well, you know, it's part of a federal grant, you know?
Yeah.
So
got to get those DWI arrests up.
If you don't get that, you don't get your Homeland Security money.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Or so you don't get the fancy new toys to be able to run the DUI checkpoints, or like the right. big like DUI vans that they go rocking with now.
Right.
I know in Manchester they have a big DUI van that they go bring to sporting events and they show off to people. And I know they got that as some sort of grant money from the state or the feds.
Because
the
Keen Bearcat.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
But James points out that this whole thing trains kids to use appeals to emotions when they're arguing a point, and which also trains them to accept an appeal to emotion as a valid premise for decision-making.
That's interesting, because there's a video that a couple of people sent to me and a few other people posted on the Facebook page where they talk about like getting kids involved in pressuring their parents for social changes. Like the school doesn't have enough balls and jump ropes, you know, so right. put pressure on your parents to get the school and use emotional language. I didn't know what to think about that, because like, why would you reveal the same tricks that you use on everybody else? You know, but I don't think that it's all one, you know, secretive group that's like, write this, it's standard, you know. What it said was there was a progressive group involved in this project. I forget the name off, Achieve Incorporated, right? So it's just some kind of progressive think tank that is actually authoring the Common Core curriculum. But what they're saying is it's being done under the approval of all 50 states, the Governors Association of the 50 states, because they gave it funding along with Bill and Melinda Gates. So it has the typical, you know, political connections, the typical progressive connections, and also, strangely enough, these big business and corporate connections.
Right. And it's all painted out. It sounds like the kind of thing that you don't want to be heard to be opposing. If you're a politician,
yeah, who wants
it's
to be
got achieve
the
in the name,
right?
How do you oppose that and not look like a douche?
And it's not a conspiracy theory. Like somebody sees this institution that exists and they say, "Oh, people are using this to control people for the outcomes that they want. Can we get in on that?" You know,
yeah.
It was the same. Like the Rockefellers, who were pretty right wing, funded John Dewey, who was like, you know, a progressive hero. But the work that he did, Rockefeller funded it. Totally different sides of the political spectrum, but all having the common goal of controlling people for some kind of...
Being a progressive hero doesn't really mean... I mean, Obama's a progressive hero. He's like the biggest progressive hero I can even think of. Right? A lot of people who I know who identify themselves as progressive are concerned about the betterment of people, I think, but...
They just don't know how to go about getting that betterment to occur, right? They always want to use the government and tax and, you know, pass laws to do it instead of some other mean that doesn't require violence. But
I'll give John Dewey the benefit of the doubt that maybe he was somebody who, and he's misquoted and quoted out of context all the time to make it sound like some of the things he said were like really nefarious. But you know, evil always catches a ride on the back of most people's good intentions.
Sure.
You know, so I think that a lot of these people, these young idealistic college students, I remember being one, you know, so I think that there are interest groups and people in the shadows that know how to take advantage of that and always have. Are we leaving anything hanging or should I jump back?
We've got this rumor that Bill and Melinda Gates are eugenicists.
Yes. Hey, that is something that is talked about all the time.
Really? I never heard that one.
No, I haven't done my research on that. Eugenics is kind of a popular idea.
It's an underground popular idea.
Yeah,
you don't necessarily want to go and say, you know, I'm for eugenics, but
you don't list that as one of your hobbies on your resume.
I'm sure, and there are circles where it is openly talked about, right?
Yeah,
sure.
Your description was much better than mine. An underground popular idea.
Yeah.
Like I've never heard it chanted at Fenway Park.
No. Right? You know. Eunics, right?
That's a great name for a sports team.
That's what people, Eunics. That's what like
the Boston Eunics, great.
Castrate the ump. You know?
Okay, so I'm going to jump back to this this Ron Paul piece. I might just sweep back a paragraph or a sentence or so. The administration is trying to turn Common Core into a national curriculum by offering states increased federal education funding if they impose Common Core's curriculum on their public schools. This is yet another example of the government using money stolen from the people to bribe states into obeying federal dictates.
Clever.
Just like highways, just like seatbelt laws, just absolutely. Like everything else.
And this is nothing new. This goes back many, many decades in education as well.
This is just like, it's just another ratchet up. And so instead of, you know, the test you have to do, now the whole curriculum is going to have to be part of the core. And next it's going to be, who knows, you know, possibly
national school uniforms.
Right, right. Or even just like how the days are segmented. No, right. You can't, all periods are going to have to be 45 minutes next, you know.
Right. Right. Critics of Common Core say it dumbs down education by replacing traditional English literature with informational texts. So students will read such inspiring materials as studies by the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, the EPA's recommended levels of insulation, and invasive plant inventory by California's Invasive Plant Council. It is doubtful that reading federal reports will teach students the habits of critical thinking and skepticism of government that the founders considered essential to maintaining a free republic.
Oh, man, when I was in high school, I hated reading what people called high literature. You know, it bored the hell out of me. If you stick federal regulations in front of high school students,
yeah.
Ugh.
And how do these things get in? Is this like the California's Invasive Plant Council? How do they get studied? Is it just anyone who can, you know, anyone who has a lobbyist who can fork enough money over can get whatever they want added to the curriculum?
Sure, there's going to be Pepsi is going to have their own, you know, set of curriculum to be taught to the students.
But this
too.
Is that's exactly
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a group of progressives says, well, we can't have people reach our ideas or our conclusions fairly. You know, I mean, I think that shows a lot about the security that people have with their belief systems that they want to impose them. People, when they're very young, they can't give anyone a fighting, thinking chance
no.
about any of this stuff because deep down they know that it has no real foundation. They want these, you know, kids, basically, or these pupils or whatever, to be mirrors of these ideas back to them, right? I think that's more of a subconscious thing. I don't want to make that sound like a conspiracy. But when that starts to happen, when you do have these interest groups who want to steer the curriculum a certain way, yes, of course, people are going to come along and say, well, since, you know, you're already kind of steering this and controlling people, let us get in on it, too.
Yeah,
basically. And that's the way it's been.
If you're
going to
force everyone
century.
Down this highway, let us put up a billboard.
I mean,
exactly.
Isn't that the whole purpose of like the PTA or the school board in general is to direct, you know, curriculum and policy based upon whatever crazy popular opinion and the parents who come in? It's all politics. It's just, you know, putting it up a different level.
Yeah, the PTA is now just really going to be organizing bake sales.
Yeah.
But
if it's not just disbanded.
Oh.
Underground PTA.
Like Obamacare, Common Core, now dubbed Obamacore by some, has sparked a backlash in the states, leading some to propose legislation forbidding state participation in the scheme. I hope these efforts lead to states not just opting out of Obamacore, but out of No Child Left Behind and other federal education programs as well. Parents can also effectively opt out of programs like Common Core by seeking alternatives to government education. It is no coincidence that as federal control over education increases, the quality of public education has declined and more parents have chosen to homeschool.
Real quick, were southern states or red states against No Child Left Behind, or are they just bitching because it now has Obama in front of the new federal school regulations?
The Republican position generally has been that more federal control over education is bad because there is this Republican paranoia, and it's funny how true it is, that there is kind of a progressive conspiracy to control education, right?
Imagine.
A big government. Government is God. Government will replace God, I think, is part of their fear. And we have some interesting allies in, what do they say, politics makes strange bedfellows.
Yep. Yes.
I'm not getting into bed with any of these folks. But, you know, we do see eye to eye on this, that this is a bad thing, but for very different reasons. they see it as like this departure from traditional values, traditional American values, or traditional Christian values. And your question, did they oppose No Child Left Behind?
It's just curious to ask that question, right? Because there are there are definitely on federal levels issues where it doesn't matter what the issue is. All that matters is who's the one talking about the idea.
The one reason why, because remember, No Child Left Behind was very bipartisan.
Yes.
Right? So one way that it would have been sold to Republicans was through the idea or the rhetoric that it's going to introduce features of a free market into a government system, right? So there's going to be accountability.
Vouchers, right? And things like that.
There's going to be rewards for good work, and there's going to be punishment or withdrawals of funding.
Oh, that's what it was about. It was more like the carrot being pulled in and out of the, or in front of the bureaucrats who run the school, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Corey, nothing on the carrot being pulled in and out?
Sorry, I was distracted.
No, I realized it when I said it. I was like, oh, no.
Ustreamer 583906 has been mentioning the European Union and U.S. cooperation in higher education and censored. And then his next comment was entirely censored and then censored. And then he writes, Public Law 106-224, June 20th, 2000, Title 4, Plant Protection, censored. Indoctrination in Common Core, ELA, censored.
If for some reason it censors certain things, one of them I think being links. Let me see if I can...
Oh, links. It's censoring the links.
Okay. Here's what I would
do. That's what it is.
If you have if you have an account at schoolsucksproject.com, you can log in and you can join the live viewers group, or you can just post an update to your account and it will appear in that activity feed. So anything that you want to share, you can definitely share on the site. The Ustream chat has a lot of limitations, but don't hesitate to, you know, take a minute to log into the site or even register. All you need, I think, is an email address and you'll get a confirmation immediately. And you can, I created a group called Live Show Viewers for people to share this stuff in a way that is less ephemeral than the chat, right? Because I don't save I can't even copy and paste and save the chats. So, you know, if you have something, if you're in our chat and you have something valuable to contribute to this, log in, start a forum post. There's lots of ways that you can share stuff with us. So don't give up. I'm sorry. Like, there's only so many things that I can juggle with Ustream at once. And I know that that's problematic for some people. So I'm sorry about that. If you're trying to post links and you're getting blocked.
So what's this about carrots?
No Child Left Behind tries to use the punishments and rewards model so popular in the schools themselves.
But it's more towards the faculty. Like, if the teachers and administrations aren't functioning properly, then the feds threaten to come in and take over the school. Isn't that part of it also?
Right, right. So, like, if I went down and talked to a principal in a school in Massachusetts and said, anybody that I work with here, I guarantee I could raise their SAT scores. In 10 or 12 hours, I could raise their SAT scores. 200 points guaranteed. He'd be like, so? I don't care. But if I said I can raise their MTEL scores, You can? You promise? Are you sure? Because that's pressure that goes on him that he in turn puts on teachers, and the teachers in turn put on students.
So, and their SAT scores won't matter until those kids are no longer his problem.
Right, right, right. So we do have a show about this. If people want to learn more, it's called No Child Left Behind and Other Bipartisan Educational Conspiracies. It is like 70 episodes ago, like somewhere around 150. And I think it was a very good show. Let's finish up this Ron Paul piece, and then we can look at a couple media clips related to Common Core. To support these parents, I have established my own homeschool curriculum. Unlike Common Core, we will not dumb down any of our offerings. Instead, the goal is to provide students with a rigorous education in history, math, English, foreign languages, and other core subjects necessary to well-rounded education. Unlike the top-down model of nationalized curriculum, the homeschool curriculum is designed to encourage maximum input from parents and students. While the curriculum will reflect my belief and interest in Austrian economics, libertarian political theory, and the history of the struggle against state power, the curriculum is being carefully designed not to show bias toward any one religion. I hope all parents of any faith or no religious belief at all will feel comfortable using the curriculum. I believe it is important for those of us concerned with education and liberty to fight our battles locally. We must oppose further encroachment on the autonomy of local public schools and work to roll back existing interference while encouraging and supporting the growth of homeschooling and other alternative education movements. The key to restoring quality education is to replace the bureaucratic control of education with a free market in education. Parents should have the freedom to select the type of education that best suits their child's unique needs. By Ron Paul. Nicely done, sir. I like him much more as a commentator than a politician.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
I like it when he said stolen money. I thought we would counter that with a video by a YouTube channel calling themselves the DC Public Schools.
Oh, boy.
Which gives us just a very quick breakdown on what Common Core actually is. So we've certainly heard some criticism of Common Core. Let's see how well it can be defended.
Oh, life I love is full of things. Measuring sticks. How smart we are, how fast we are, how well we can, you know, compete. But up until now, it's been pretty hard to tell how well kids are competing in school and how well they're going to do when they get out of school. We like to think that our education system does that. But when it comes to learning what they really need to be successful after graduation, is a girl in your neighborhood being taught as much as her friend over in the next one? Is a graduating senior in, say, St. Louis as prepared to get a job as the graduate in Shanghai? Well, it turns out the answer to both of these questions is no. Because for years, states have been setting different standards for what students should know and be able to do at each grade level. That's making it too hard to know if our kids are really doing well enough overall. And if they can really compete for a job someday. What we really need are clear goals. That's where the Common Core state standards come in. They're like a total sea change in education. Consistent, strong, clear benchmarks for English language arts and math. Here's how it works. You can think of kindergarten through 12th grade like a giant staircase. Each step is a skill your child needs to learn before stepping up to the next one. But right now, too many kids aren't really confident with like 2+2 before they have to move on to 2x2. We need more focus on the skills that help them move up the stairs, or they can slip up and fall behind. And there's another problem. What if everyone's stairs were made at different heights? Well, here we go again. They are. So, a boy in Seattle who's rocking an A in English literature could be getting a C on his Chicago friend's staircase. Oops. We need to create consistent steps in education, too. So first, each standard creates a landing on the staircase, a stop along the way as your child heads toward high school graduation. Each stop is a chance for every parent and teacher to focus on the skills their students are supposed to know at that step, no matter the zip code, language, or race. And more importantly, each standard makes sure all students are learning what they need to know to get to graduation and beyond. Because something like counting to 100 leads to understanding dollars and cents, which eventually leads to understanding how to manage a budget. Secondly, the standards are consistent from school to school, and they match up against international standards, too. Now we know how we're doing compared to just about everyone. So even though local communities will still design their own curriculum, with the same rules, everybody can compete on the same kind of staircase. But standards aren't learning. That's why we need teachers, parents, and students to help make that happen. By working together to help kids meet these standards, the world's getting more and more competitive every day. But now, when our kids get to the top of their staircase, they can have way more options on where their life goes from there. Clear goals, confident, well-prepared students. That's the Common Core state standards.
I wish I could have somebody like animate all my podcasts like this.
What I said. I love when I've seen a lot of those videos with that cartoonist where he just draws everything real fast. Those are always interesting and fun to watch.
Yeah.
Although that one, just that whole thing made no sense to me at all.
I think it
makes sense.
Yeah.
Well,
but I think it's very wrong-headed.
Yeah. I think superficially it sounds very nice.
Lots of platitudes being spouted out half-truths.
Yeah. And the information is very incomplete. Like they talk about, you know, never mind the
fact that the people who are making these decisions, looking around at what's going on nowadays, these people have no idea what people need to know to be competitive. in the job market. No idea at all. None. Well, they think we all need to go to college.
But they say, oh, well, everyone's working together. We're bringing their special knowledge and skills into this.
Not just that, but it's like everyone needs to get involved. So we're not really responsible if they fail. Everyone is responsible if they fail, right?
This whole thing goes tits up, it's because the parents didn't get involved.
Right. So they've already set their deflection off, you know.
Well, this is the back away that they always do so nicely. When you talk to people who work in these schools or are apologists for the public schools, they talk about funding, right? And they say, don't you understand how important what we're doing is? Like, this is, you know, do you understand what the responsibility we have? And then when you say, okay, well, what about these problems with, like, the numbers, your own metrics for measuring, like, how well you do? Like, well, you know, some of it is up to the parents as well. So the blame immediately shifts from we're doing the most important work in the world to, well, it's really, you know, it's kind of on the parents. So you're right. There is that kind of trying to spread the blame a little bit. But what I think is interesting about this, and I know I keep bringing up this woman, Peg Luksic, and if people haven't seen that, I encourage you to watch the YouTube video. Obviously, transferred to YouTube from some kind of VHS tape.
Yeah.
You will notice. She is saying pretty much the same thing as far as, like, what is really going into this national curriculum. And it's more than just learning stuff. So I think it would be interesting here to see what happens at the, what did they call those things? The landings?
Yeah, the steps and landings.
The stairs have landings.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? Well, everybody catches up to the landing, right? So everybody is at the same place. Which is impossible anyway.
Yeah, like how, like, they mentioned that, you know, we know when, like, someone is supposed to know this piece of information. You're going to be this old and you're going to learn this, and that's how everyone's going to be. And when everyone is caught up to this point, then you can move on. And that's absurd, right?
Right. If you get to the if you get to the landing first, you have to sit around and wait for everybody else to catch up.
Right.
Which is school anyway, which is school in a nutshell.
Or you have to be embarrassed to be the last kid to make it up there.
Yeah, right. You know.
But there's a whole other aspect to this as well, and that's what's going on these landings.
Right.
So we don't have the Common Core materials that are being used in elementary school, where they are going to be probably the heaviest hitting, you know, as far as, like, the impressionable nature of kids at that age and the messages that are going to be delivered. So let's take a look. A couple of people here made a video who have gotten their hands on some of these materials. What goes on the landings?
What's this book?
All right, so this is for third graders. But one thing I noticed as I went through third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh grade is they all had this similar theme, where here for literature and writing, in the literature and writing class, the purpose and goal that's stated is that they want teachers to be measuring attitudes, beliefs, and dispositions, and they actually give them a rubric and a chart for tracking that.
What?
Yeah, and again, this is approved for primary use in the state of Utah. So we have a student observation form. Just zoom in on that. The student observation form on the assessment handbook is an informal assessment tool that notes growth and change in individual students' behaviors and attitudes.
Now, that's also another buzzword, informal assessments. When I was in graduate school, we called them authentic assessments.
Hmm.
So, which is kind of like naturally evaluating versus more standardized. We were taught immediately once we got to the teacher certification program and in graduate school, you be against standardized tests. And I'm not for them anywhere, but that was pushed very heavily on us. Standardized tests are bad. Standardized tests are bad. There is no debate. Standardized tests are bad, right? Because they're bad for teachers because they mean accountability,
mm-hmm.
right? So straight from the NEA into the halls of graduate education programs everywhere, standardized tests are bad. So we were really taught to fall in love with these authentic, or as they call them here, informal assessments. But that allows a lot of stuff to be pushed into the minds of these kids that isn't going to show up, you know, on some form that gets sent home to parents. But it is going to show up somewhere. Gatto wrote this other article where he said, like, in the 80s, he's like, you do have a permanent record, right? And it sounds like, well, you know, that's kind of a tinfoil hat thing to say. But if this is what he was talking about, it is true that this information is being recorded and cataloged and delivered to interested parties. And the Who Controls Our Children video explains it all very well. Who wants this information and why?
Point of interest, Ustreamer 156518 points out that Peg Luxick video was from 1992.
Okay.
Just, so, you know, because it keeps coming up, so.
Yeah, 21 years ago.
He also points out, and this is a really interesting point, can you imagine a steps and landing process like that in, say, professional sports? Imagine if we tried to apply this to everything, right? Like, you know.
Well, just in any professional set of life. I mean,
yeah, in real life, just anywhere outside of school, this would not make any sense.
Right, right. I think that there's that aspect to it, too. But
so when these kids grow up and they get a job and they're shitty at their job and nobody waits around for them to get better, they just get fired. They're not going to understand what's going on.
Right, right. All right, so let's see what else these guys have to say.
In the rubric here, you know, does the student effectively use the first person plural, we, and our, to advocate ways to solve social problems?
Wait.
Did everyone catch that?
No, I didn't catch that.
So disgusting. Oh, my.
Let me just roll it back.
And so in the rubric here, you know, does the student effectively use the first person plural, we, and our, to advocate ways to solve social problems?
What?
Yep. Goodness.
There is no, what's that Rand book, Anthem?
Yeah.
And there is no I.
There is no I.
That's really scary. That's even further beyond what I even thought that they were, like, cataloging, you know, in public schools.
Yeah, that is actually kind of like deeply terrifying.
Yes, yes, I would have to agree with that.
I'm having a hard time even making a joke.
Speaking of steps and landings, wouldn't it be really consistent of them if they said that you can't bully children into doing what you want, and you certainly can't enact some kind of physical violence on them until they have grown to the same size as you? So you can't threaten kids with detention or suspension or any of that stuff until they've reached the proper maturity to be able to defend themselves intellectually from your sort of empty threats.
Well, then how are they going to learn how to accept those empty threats?
Right, exactly.
Like, this is kind of
training citizens here. Come on.
From the chat, I proctored a midterm for AP Environmental Science, and it had 8 questions matching presidents with environmental-related bills they signed into law. In a science course.
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt, he was probably a big one. Science is super political.
Yes.
These days. All right, let's see what else. I can't read the second one. I'm kind of afraid to learn what it is.
Are they learning how to do that? And again, the rubric here includes things like, do they understand and know when something is unfair? Do they recognize social problems?
Fair.
Do they work with others to solve group problems? Again, with changing behaviors and attitudes. And those are the stated goals here for the Zehner Blaser Voices, Literature, and Writing.
So this is for 9-year-olds?
Third graders, yeah. Nothing wrong with working with others to solve social problems.
No.
Right? But what's the problem with that?
Such a good question.
Yeah, and I forgot what I was going to say. That's why I phrased it as a question. There is a problem with it. Working with others to solve social problems, mm-hmm. where if somebody asserts their individual need, you know, like part of self-esteem is like self-advocacy and self-assertiveness.
Right.
So if somebody says, no, 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 this doesn't really work for me, folks, teach. And say, oh, well, you're not working with others to solve the problem. You're being selfish. You know, and what was the one before that? Fairness?
Fair. Yeah, it's like one of the best lessons I learned as an adult was there is no such thing as fair. Fair is something someone told you that was a lie, and you shouldn't take it seriously because it just doesn't exist in the universe. And the closer you get to, or the faster you learn that, the happier you're eventually going to be. And so the fact that they're trying to tell people that, oh, you know, you should try to be fair, or that fair is something that actually exists, that's very bothersome.
So it's a filler word for like a more complex problem, because there is times when you want to be fair.
There's right? equitable, right? There's like equal shares, and to have, you know, to transfer equal amounts of value, you know, and to get to like trade and exchange, you know, you can claim that is fair, but it's
reciprocity.
Really. Right, right. Mm-hmm. That's more. That's a much better definition than fair.
So it's a more complex problem of human negotiation than to just say, nope, well, we're going to do a zero tolerance on unfairness.
Right. Well, it's also like the lowest common denominator. What is fair for everyone in a group of 30 people is usually the worst for, 90% of everyone.
Yeah, as James points out right here in the chat, fair is subjective, you know.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Like some people will say it's fair, it's not fair that somebody can't afford to pay their bills, but that doesn't make it fair for me to be forced to cover the difference. You know?
So right.
Fair is not fair. People say fair is fair, but it's not.
Right.
It's all in the eye of the beholder.
I want to wind this video back to what somebody mentioned in the chat. It might have been James about the emotional language.
Yes, I believe it was.
It is worth hearing and seeing in the book. And I will, when this becomes a podcast, I will link these videos in the show notes.
Theme: students use their voices to advocate solutions to social problems that they care deeply about it. They're engaged in learning the following theme-related social knowledge and skills. And then they list them: social role models, social advocacy, respect, and so on and so forth. So,
well, that is important for a first grader.
Yeah, right. Just to learn how to be an advocate for social.
Yeah, right. <You're kidding>. My 6-year-old does that all the time.
Right. She looks what's wrong in the world and says, how do I organize my people in my community to fix these social problems? Well, the teachers are shown how to teach them how to do exactly that. One of the first things that they teach the 6-year-olds is how to use emotional words. Now, I have to tell you, my 6-year-old already knows the emotional words because she's... We have emotional conversations, but it's not what they want. What they're looking for is... here's the instruction to the teacher. Tell students that when they write a call to action, they should include emotional words to get the readers to feel so strongly about the problem that they want to do what is being asked of them. This is not Community Organization 101 for college students. This is English Language Arts for 6-year-olds.
So this other talk, I wanted to be able to put a name to it. It was called UNA 21, U.S. Education Goal, Dumb and Dumber. This also looks like it is probably about 15 years old. Michael Chapman is his name. And he also wrote a piece called Education for Sustainable Tyranny. And he was just a regular run-of-the-mill conservative. And the purpose of this show, which was episode 155, No Child Left Behind and Other Bipartisan Education Conspiracies, it took voices from the right, like this Luxick woman that I've mentioned several times, and Michael Chapman, and voices as far left as Noam Chomsky, and illustrated all of the objections to the No Child Left Behind legislation. People who were, while they might have been very different in their political ideologies and orientations, were very, very concerned with the state's drive to control more people, more ways. So Chomsky would call himself kind of libertarian, like an anarcho-syndicalist, anarcho-socialist, maybe. These other people, small, Christian-driven, small government conservatives, right? So very, very different, but that both have that common concern of the government's drive to control more people and the understanding that that is a bad thing. So, once you get to Capitol Hill, everybody's on the same team there.
Can we pause for just a second? Because somebody just posted a really disturbing quote from the Education for Sustainable Development Toolkit, Volume 2, dated 2002, quote, "Generally, more highly educated people who have higher incomes consume more resources than poorly educated people who tend to have lower incomes. In this case, more education increases the threat to sustainability."
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah. And that's in that show. I think I used that quote, that clip. And it's in this video if you want to watch it. Did he give the name of it? Was it Education for Sustainable Tyranny?
He quoted it as being part of the Education for Sustainable Development Toolkit, Volume 2.
So a lot of people talk about Agenda 21. Are you familiar with that? Mm-hmm. Now, I have a friend who's on a local school board who insists that he remain nameless on this show because I think he's kind of afraid. But on a town surrounding Manchester is on the school board and talks about the Agenda 21 as a real thing and influencing school policy right down to a local level. So today we have something called Common Core. This Michael Chapman period, Education for Sustainable Tyranny, and this Dumb and Dumber video, 10 years ago. The Peg Luxick, Who Controls Our Children, mm-hmm. 10 years before that. So the same idea, driven by the same agendas and ideologies, just keeps being recycled, renamed, and popping up again and again. And when it does, same kind of people try to latch onto it and use it for their agenda as well. Because it's control, right? So if the momentum is already going that way, why not hitch a ride? Here's one more piece on the funding dealing with Common Core, and then I think we can wrap this up.
The real power here is the Gates Foundation, which has spent over $100 million helping create and propagate the standards and has plans to spend many millions more. But over the long haul, with all the technology and new curriculum that this new educational paradigm requires, companies such as Microsoft will more than recover the money they have invested. There is a great deal of money to be made at the educational trough.
I'm trying to understand how these private groups could have so much influence over 50 states. Is the federal government involved in this?
Secretary of Education Arne Duncan is a huge proponent of Common Core, and under his direction, the Federal Department of Education has used its power of the purse to essentially bribe states to adopt the standards. In the spring of 2009, the infamous stimulus bill gave the Department of Education a $4.35 billion earmark, money to use however the department wanted. The department created the Race to the Top competition, whereby the federal government took our money and gave us the chance to compete to get some of it back. States could apply for Race to the Top grants, but to have a realistic shot at getting the money, they had to agree to adopt the Common Core standards and the national tests, the assessments, aligned with the Common Core, all sight unseen, because at that time the standards had not even been completed, and the testing component is still not complete. The Race to the Top application came out in November 2009, and completed applications were due only 2 months later. Now remember, at that time the country was in a deep recession, and states were desperate for money. It's also important to note that between the months of November and early January, most state legislatures are not in session. So desperate state officials had to decide without consulting their legislatures whether to commit to the Common Core and all it entails in order to get Race to the Top money. The other way the federal government is promoting Common Core is through No Child Left Behind waivers. The U.S. Department of Education is encouraging states to adopt Common Core in order to qualify for a waiver from the most demanding provisions of No Child Left Behind.
Wait, real quick. So they're using the new like legislation bureaucracy to lessen their like effects of the last legislation that went through? It's just so absurd, right?
That is what they're doing, right? You're exactly right.
Maybe No Child Left Behind was only created for that purpose.
To push Common Core?
Yeah.
I like your paranoia, but
no. Nick from Melbourne says in Australia they're trying to get a national curriculum put through the Senate where every 18-year-old student has to sit the same test.
Yeah,
that's not so different from this. Everybody's going to be taking the same test. It's not just the 18-year-olds; they're going to be taking the same test every year.
Remember too that in other countries, people might be more habituated to certain types of collectivism and regimentation. That there are a variety of different ideologies in America, be they from the left or from the right, that want to fight this kind of control, you know? And that might just not be an issue in some places. Like, people who want to improve American public school always look towards Japan, right? Well, in Japan, in, like I mentioned before, a very, very collectivistic culture and very, very, I think, in many ways, obedient culture, they can kind of just ram stuff through, you know, like, oh, well, right. we're doing this now. And
I think we're getting there, too. And when I say we, I mean they.
Yeah, but there are some very small, and most people are followers. I mean, this is a mass conspiracy of obedience and thoughtlessness that allows this kind of stuff to happen. But there are always going to be, I think, small but very vocal minorities that speak up in resistance to this stuff. And we see that it doesn't take too many people, right? It doesn't take a majority, in this case anyway, to send them back to the drawing board.